Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a graduate education flexible enough to allow you to explore what matters most to you. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. When and where might the next tsunami strike the world's ever more crowded coastlines, and will those in its path be able to escape in time? The destruction caused by the Indian Ocean tsunami of 2004 and the one that inundated Sendai, Japan last year serve as stark reminders of the terrifying power of these geologic phenomena and of the challenges involved in helping those at risk escape to higher ground in time. Journalist Tim Folger covers the issue in his article, The Calm Before the Wave. It appears in the February 2012 issue of National Geographic magazine. Tim, welcome to Think.
Thanks very much, Chris. Thanks for having me.
What sort of tectonic activity is most often responsible for tsunamis?
There are two sorts of earthquakes, and the one that causes tsunamis is caused by when two of Earth's plates collide and one will dive beneath the other. Ocean plates are denser than continental plates, and when a dense oceanic plate dives beneath a lighter continental plate, the oceanic plate will sometimes spring up against the overlying continental plate, and then the seafloor will just start vibrating like a diving board, and that will set in motion the entire column of water above the seafloor, and that's what causes most tsunamis.
What's so interesting about that is that often this, it's called subduction, happens without causing problems, but then occasionally there is a snag sort of between one plate and the other.
That's right. It's kind of mysterious why some subduction zone earthquakes will cause tsunamis and some won't. Scientists need to know to do a lot more research. The historical record of earthquakes is really quite short. You know, we've only had modern instrumentation for, you know, a little over a century. And, of course, earthquakes have been happening since the planet, you know, shortly after the planet formed. Mm-hmm. And it's just not known which of the subduction zones around the world are dangerous, you know, in which ones, you know, can be ignored. Kelly C, a scientist in Singapore, told me that, you know, we really can't assume that any subduction zone is quiet and safe.
And the water can travel so far after this happens that one does not have to be close enough to actually experience the earthquake on land in order to be at risk from the tsunami.
That's right. The largest earthquake on record occurred in Chile in 1960. It was a 9.5 magnitude earthquake, I think. And besides the deaths it caused in Chile, it also killed people in Japan, you know, entirely across the Pacific Ocean.
And away from the coastline, at the epicenter where this is all taking place, all that energy being released is barely visible on the surface of the water.
Yeah, if you're at far enough at sea, it's the safest place to be during a tsunami. You might notice, an increase in wave height of, you know, a couple of feet, but that'll pass pretty quickly beneath you. The tsunami only becomes dangerous when all that water gets close to the shore and it starts piling up against the continental shelf in shallower water. And, at the point where the tsunami occurred, the water might have been several thousand feet deep, so you have that entire mass of water moving to the shore. It's kind of like a rug crumpling up against a wall. You just have this huge buildup of water when the wave finally reaches the shore.
Is there always a characteristic withdrawal of the tide before a tsunami hits?
Not always, but if you're near the shore and you see a bay suddenly emptying,
get out of there.
You want to start running.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So let's talk about how detection buoys work, because there are more of them now than there were before the Indian Ocean tsunami, but there still aren't not that many operating in the world.
No, right now there are a little over 50 in the world's oceans, And unfortunately, there are only about six, I believe, in the Indian Ocean where the most destructive tsunamis have occurred. There are plans to install more of them, you know, in the years ahead.
And what do they do exactly?
Yeah, it's a three-part system. There's a pressure sensor that's anchored to the seafloor that senses changes in water pressure that are associated with the tsunami. You know, you have that huge column of water that passes over the sensor. The pressure goes up, and that bottom sensor sends a sonar signal to a surface buoy, which in turn relays that data to a satellite, which sends the information to tsunami warning centers around the world.
And we can't say for certain how much warning time they give, because a lot depends on how close one is to the geologic activity that's taking place.
That's right. In the worst tsunami on record, the one that hit the Indian Ocean in 2004 on December 26th, people nearest the epicenter in northern Sumatra in Indonesia had essentially no warning, just 20 minutes or less to run. They felt the shaking at that time, and I met many people in Banda Aceh who, before the 2004 tsunami, none of them had ever heard the word tsunami. They didn't know what a tsunami was. They didn't know what to do, when an earthquake struck. So as a result, Banda Aceh, a city in North Sumatra, it lost something like 70,000 to 90,000 people. Indonesia as a whole lost about 170,000 people. 230,000 people were killed around the Indian Ocean, and many of those deaths could have been prevented had a warning system been in place. The tsunami epicenter, as I said, was just off the northwest coast of Sumatra, so the people in Sumatra had essentially no warning, just a few minutes. But in India, if a warning system had been in place, many lives could have been saved, because the tsunami took about 2 hours to travel from the epicenter in Indonesia to India. But still, at that time, there was no warning system in place, and about 16,000 people died in India, and I think 60,000 people as a whole in India, Sri Lanka, and other countries further west in the Indian Ocean.
And the death toll obviously was an indication for all of us of the magnitude of this thing. I had not been aware until I read your piece that this tsunami was the result of a lifting of the seabed as much as 20 feet along a 1,000-mile stretch of the floor.
It's incredible. It's just hard to imagine those forces. Even the one in Japan last March, which the Japanese call it 311, that was... I think that was much more concentrated. I think only about a 280-mile-long fault shifted, but it probably shifted some parts of Japan by about 80 feet to the east, and it shifted the Earth's axis by about 17 centimeters.
Wow.
And sped up the planet's rotation by a microsecond or so.
You open the piece with a very dramatic story of this Japanese city, Minami Sanriku, and I don't know if I'm saying that even remotely correctly, but it was inundated by the tsunami last year that also hit Sendai and other places. The mayor of that city tells this riveting story of how he managed to survive. Can you tell us about that?
Sure. It's quite an incredible story of survival. The mayor's name is Jin Sato, and your pronunciation, I think, is probably as good as mine. I was saying Minami Sanriku. And Mayor Sato, the day the tsunami hit, he was actually holding a meeting in his town about tsunami preparedness, because an earthquake had hit the area just a couple of days before, and scientists now realize that earthquake was a precursor to the larger March 11th earthquake that triggered the tsunami. So during that meeting, the big earthquake hit, and Mayor Sato and a couple of dozen of his colleagues at the meeting ran right next door to the town's three-story emergency evacuation center, which was, served kind of a dual purpose. People who were close to that center could run there, go up to the third floor, and supposedly be safe from the tsunami. And it was also a communications and control center where the mayor and his team could, you know, coordinate rescue efforts and issue warnings. When the waves started coming in, a young woman was on the second floor broadcasting a tsunami warning, and she kept that broadcast up until the tsunami hit the building. Her name was Miki Endo. She was 24 years old, and she died making that broadcast. Meanwhile, Mayor Sato and a couple of dozen of his colleagues were on the roof of the building watching the tsunami come in, and they realized that their building wasn't going to be tall enough to save them. And the town also had a seawall that was about 18 feet tall that was built after the 1960 tsunami that was triggered by an earthquake in Chile actually flooded Minami San Rico and killed about 40 people there. But the 18-foot-high seawall wasn't enough to stop this tsunami, which was probably about three times higher than that. So this wave, you know, flooded, just covered this three-story building. Sato and about 10 other people climbed onto a radio antenna, and still they spent the night clinging to this antenna while the wave waves periodically just inundated them during the night. And that's another dangerous thing about tsunamis, is that it's not just one wave, but it's a series of waves, sometimes separated by, you know, a couple of hours. So Mayor Sato and his colleagues kind of endured this nightmarish night. The next morning, the people who hadn't made it up to the radio antenna, most of them had been washed away. And there were only 10 survivors, including Mayor Sato. The next morning, their town, Minami San Rico, was pretty much washed away.
Yeah, the article is, as is the wont of National Geographic, is accompanied by some amazing photographs. And there's a series that shows the water level climbing and then finally declining in that town. And presumably, it is the mayor that we see clinging to that antenna.
Yes, he's one of the people in that photo.
Did he say anything about what it sounds like when all that water comes in? Is it just like listening to the ocean?
The sounds he remembered most were things being crushed by a tsunami. The wood frame houses, masonry, vehicles just being swept along. And then the aftermath. I've never been in a war zone, or I've never seen firsthand a city that's been bombed, but Minami San Rico and the other towns along the northeast coast of Japan really look like they've been bombed, just completely flattened, just piles of debris everywhere.
Were you there within days after the wave had hit?
No, I was actually, some photographers from National Geographic went there within the days after the tsunami, but I didn't go until the summer. But cleanup efforts were underway by the time I was visiting the towns. But still, there were no more towns. People were just living in refugee camps, and they'll be living in refugee centers for probably at least another 2 years. And many of those towns, they'll just never be rebuilt.
Journalist Tim Folger is with us. His article, The Calm Before the Wave, appears in the February 2012 issue of National Geographic magazine. If you want to talk about tsunamis or ask a question, you can join us at 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is journalist Tim Folger. We're talking about his article, The Calm Before the Wave, which is featured in the current issue of National Geographic. If you'd like to join us, you can call in to 1-800-933-5372 or send your question via email to think@kera.org. Tim, Japan has spent billions of dollars on earthquake and tsunami preparation. How does that money get spent?
It's spent to reinforce buildings. Japan's building codes are very strict, and they're way ahead of us in terms of earthquake preparedness. And the March 2011 tsunami, in some ways, vindicated Japan's preparedness. The earthquake itself did very little damage. Most of the damage and loss of life was actually caused by the tsunami. Japan does have pretty effective tsunami defenses. Something like 40% of Japan's coastline in the northeast part of the country, I think, has seawalls. And most of the seawalls failed in the tsunami. The tsunami was just much bigger than anyone had expected. But there was one town, a town named Fudai, that built a 50-foot-tall seawall back in the 1990s. I didn't get to include this in my article, but the mayor of this town, for years, tried to convince this town to raise the money to build this seawall, and of course they received funding from the national government too. The town kind of laughed at this man, but now he's regarded as a hero because this town seawall was the only one that actually didn't fail because it was high enough to stop the tsunami.
You know, it's really interesting to think about something like that and the debates that it would raise, because there's not only the cost of it, given the relatively rare phenomenon of tsunamis, but I would imagine there were people who protested something like the loss of the view of the ocean.
That's right. It's hard to imagine, 40% of, say, the Pacific Northwest being lined with protective seawalls. That's really the dilemma. How does society prepare for events that might happen only once every two or three centuries, but that when they do happen, they'll be disastrous in terms of loss of life and property? So how do you budget for that, for disasters that occur every 200 or 300 years? The Japanese have been fairly successful this, even despite the the loss of some 20,000 people last March. Things could have been much worse without Japan's defenses. A little over a century ago, in 1896, the same part of Japan was hit by a tsunami. When Japan's population was about a third of what it is today, but the loss of life in that 1896 tsunami was about 20,000, about the same number of people that died last March, even though the population now is much higher. So Japan's defenses certainly worked, and their investment paid off in saving lives.
So it is food for thought, as you mentioned, particularly for the Pacific Northwest region of this country, which is apparently overdue for a tsunami.
Yes. Scientists know that the Pacific Northwest has been hit by tsunamis in the past, and the last one has even been dated to the very day and almost to the hour. And it happened on January 26th in 1700. So we just passed the 10 days ago was 312th anniversary of the last tsunami to hit the Pacific Northwest. And, of course, that was before any Europeans had settled the area, and it was before the Pacific Northwest even existed on maps. It was just kind of a terra incognita at the time. But geologists have found this telltale footprint, if you will, of a tsunami in sand deposits all along the coast from, say, British Columbia down to northern Oregon. You can find this really thin layer of sand that's sandwiched between layers of, decayed vegetation.
So it's the detritus left behind by the wave.
Right. It's sand that was carried inland, deposited on top of, forest, and then then forest decayed on top of that after forest started to grow again. And the scientists were able to date that fairly roughly. They knew what happened, 300 years ago, give or take some decades. But then back in the 1990s, a geologist named Brian Atwater, who at the time I think was working for the U.S. Geological Survey, working with colleagues in Japan, he realized that a tsunami that had occurred in Japan in 1700 was probably caused by this subduction zone off the Pacific Northwest coast, the Cascadia subduction zone. Japan has very good historical records of tsunami, but this one tsunami that occurred in 1700 had always been referred to by the Japanese as an orphan tsunami because there was no earthquake associated with it. Mm. It just seemed to come out of nowhere. And Brian Atwater and working with a number of other scientists were able to show that that so-called orphan tsunami in Japan was caused by the an earthquake that was triggered, an earthquake that triggered a tsunami along the Cascadia subduction zone.
Wow.
In 1700, and with the Japanese records, they realized it was January 26, 1700, and happened sometime in the night in the Pacific Northwest.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Journalist Tim Folger is my guest. Let's go to the phones now. We'll speak with Jeff in Fort Worth. Hi, Jeff.
Hi, Chris. How are you?
Great. Thank you.
Good. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I wanted to inquire, and forgive me for not having the geographic location, but I recall either reading or an article or watching something on TV in regards to subduction zone. I want to say either off the coast of Europe or East Africa, or I'm sorry, West Africa, that has, I guess, a large amount of sediment, and that whatever the next, you know, decent-sized quake disturbs the sediment enough that it's going to create a tsunami that's going to travel across the Atlantic Ocean and impact the East Coast. And I was wondering if there's any information that your guest could shed on that and maybe ways to predict that.
Thanks for calling. Do you know anything about that, Tim?
There have been tsunamis in the Atlantic. The most famous one destroyed Lisbon in 1755. Records of tsunami deposits along the Atlantic in North America, unfortunately, aren't as well studied. That this is an area that needs more research, but there have been tsunamis in the Atlantic Ocean. There have been tsunamis in the Mediterranean. Just about there, in the Caribbean, there have been tsunamis just about any part of the world you can think of.
You write about the fact that Lisbon tsunami was sort of a critical feature in Candide by Voltaire.
That's right. the tsunami and earthquake destroyed Lisbon, killing thousands. And Voltaire satirized the notion of a kindly a god who created the best of all possible worlds for us to live in. This tsunami and earthquake of 1755 really was an important event in European thought and during the Enlightenment in terms of leading people to question the notion of just what kind of world do we live in, and is it a designed world ruled by a kindly deity?
Well, it makes sense that anyone who's been through something like this and managed to survive would question almost everything they'd ever believed.
That's right. You know, when you talk with people who have survived these events, you wonder, how do they retain their faith? And I met many devout Muslims in Indonesia, and I asked them that, and they said, well, this is the way the world is. It's not God punishing us. It's just the way the world is. And this one very devout woman that I met, Patra Arena Devi, who runs a volunteer organization in a city called Padang in Indonesia to raise tsunami awareness, said that, well, without earthquakes and volcanoes, you wouldn't have volcanoes depositing fertile soil for us to grow crops. And so the world is a dangerous place, and tsunamis are just one of the things that we have to live with, and it's a good thing they don't happen more often than they do.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak next on the phone to Joe in Las Colinas. Hello, Joe.
Hey, hello. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
While I was waiting, I've got actually a second question, too. But my first question was associated with these tsunamis, these seismic events. Is there any record recently, like the one in Japan or Chile, of any electromagnetic disturbances? Historically, I think I recall reading about, like, you know, some glowing in the evening sky or, you know, like something akin to an aurora. And then the second question is, the timing of these events recently, were they in conjunction with a full moon and full tides and things of that nature?
Thanks for your call.
No, you know, I don't know of any electromagnetic events that were associated with tsunamis, and I don't believe the phase of the moon is associated with tsunamis either. It's really the movement of Earth's crustal plates. You know, the Earth's crust is fractured, like, you know, kind of like if you take a hard-boiled egg and squeezed it, and just see all these series of cracks appear, and they're in constant motion because the Earth's crust is really riding on top of, you know, this material further beneath that's in constant motion. All this material is rising and falling inside the Earth, and Earth's continents and the seafloors are riding on top of that. And, you know, sometimes, you know, the oceanic crust will slide beneath a continent, and if during that sliding the oceanic crust might get stuck against the overlying continent for some period of time, but then after some centuries or eons, that will eventually break free, and we'll feel that as an earthquake.
Do governments of areas known to be at great risk for tsunamis encourage people to sort of drill for evacuation?
Yes, in Japan and Indonesia now, especially since the 2004 tsunami, drills are held regularly. Even in the Pacific Northwest now, since scientists have revealed that we're overdue for a tsunami there, there are tsunami warning sirens on many beaches in Washington and Oregon, and those are tested periodically.
Of course, in these densely populated areas, I'm trying to think about, you know, a city, an urban area as large as the one we live in here in North Texas. Even if you had 2 hours, even if you had 24 hours of warning, it would be nearly impossible to get everybody far out of the way.
That's the tragedy, especially in this country where we're behind, we're way behind Japan. I think we're behind Indonesia in terms of preparedness. In the areas that are most at risk in the United States, that's Washington State, Oregon, and Northern California, there are tsunami evacuation routes that are marked. And if you stay in a hotel along the coast in many of those areas, if you, you know, open your drawer in your hotel room, you'll probably find a card with instructions about what to do during a tsunami. The problem is that there's, as you said, very little warning between the time an earthquake hits and the time the tsunami will arrive. You might have 20 minutes at the most. And there are no evacuation centers yet in the Pacific Northwest. What you have to do now is hop in your car and drive to high ground, and, you know, you can imagine the traffic jams, especially in some of these small coastal communities where you might just have a two-lane road. And in the summer, you know, those roads would be jammed, and, you know, there's just no way that enough people would, you know, escape the tsunami. The death toll could be quite high there.
Is this the kind of thing people in the Pacific Northwest are beginning to worry about, or do people sort of laugh and say, well, we've been here for 200, 300 years and not had a problem?
No, I think people are certainly worried about it, and communities have been meeting with government agencies to try to start planning for the construction of evacuation centers. And I was told that, you know, if there were funding, we could have, you know, a pretty good network of evacuation centers and escape routes, you know, up within 5 years. The problem is political will and funding.
Hmm. Yeah, it's almost like unless you give them a dual purpose, it's hard to come up with the money to put those things in place.
That's right, and many of them would be dual purpose. They could be parking garages. They, you know, in some parts of Washington, they're talking about building large earthen berms that, you know, could be built in parks where you could have, I don't know, you know, recreational areas built on them. So as you said, yeah, they would most likely be dual purpose areas.
Did you happen to investigate at all, and I know it's not in the piece, but how insurance companies account for these things and calculate the risks?
That's a good question. You know, I didn't really go into that, Chris.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's a beautiful photograph of some property that is apparently in the path of the Cascadia Fault if something happens there in the Pacific Northwest. And I suppose people would have to factor that in as they insure property.
Yeah, that's right. And again, I'm not sure what sorts of insurance there might be against you know, earthquake and tsunami damage.
Is anybody saying we shouldn't have settlements in places that could be hit by these things? I mean, you also have to factor 300 years without a problem against one devastating day that could wipe everything out.
Yeah. There are certainly people who say we shouldn't be building in some of these areas and that we have overbuilt in many of these areas. It's not so much the case in the Pacific Northwest, which is mostly sparsely populated along the coast, so you can't really say we've put too many people there. It's just that they're popular in the summertime when, you know, people just flock to the coast. But in other parts of the world, Japan and Indonesia, you know, there's no place else for these people to go.
Yeah.
There are, you know, big cities like Padang, a city of nearly a million, that is really at a very high risk for a tsunami.
Let me jump in here for a break. Tim Folger is with us. We're talking about The Calm Before the Wave, his article in the current issue of National Geographic magazine. We'll be back in a minute. The number is 1-800-933-5372, or you can email think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is journalist Tim Folger. His article, The Calm Before the Wave, appears in the February 2012 issue of National Geographic magazine. If you'd like to join us, our telephone number is 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org. Before the break, Tim, you were saying that For island nations like Japan, like Indonesia, that are in fact at great risk for tsunamis, there's really nowhere else for their populations to go if they don't live right by the coastline.
Yeah, that is really the dilemma of this century. This one scientist I spoke with in Singapore named Kerry C put it very eloquently. You know, he said it's not that scientists don't know enough, and it's not that engineers aren't, you know, engineering enough. It's just that there are too many of us now living in places that are in harm's way. And the way Kerry C. put it was that he thinks that this 21st century will be a century of consequences just by our, I don't even know if it's a choice. It's just where given the realities of population growth and the location of cities will be seen more like Minami Sanrikus and more Banda Aches in the century ahead.
How serious is the problem of false alarms, where there has been activity on the seafloor, but it may not, for whatever reason, translate into a very extraordinary breach of the coastline?
Yeah, that's a good question. I don't think false alarms are too much of a problem with tsunami warnings. They don't occur too often, and when they do, or when there have been false alarms, I think they've been, in the cases I'm aware of, maybe they've had a sense of reassuring the population. There was a false alarm in the city of Padang, Indonesia, a few years ago. There was an earthquake and a tsunami warning. This was after the 2004 earthquake and tsunami, so people knew, you know, what horrors a tsunami could inflict. So thousands of people in Padang, you know, walked along the evacuation routes trying to go to the high ground that was in most cases probably a mile or two away. So I think it reassured people that, well, the warning system is there and we can save some lives.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's speak now to Ben in Dallas. Hello, Ben.
Oh, hey there. I had an interesting story that a friend from, told the story in Toastmasters about how he actually saved people's lives because, coincidentally, he had just finished a science fair project, and this is in India, on tsunamis and how they work. And so he was in Kanyakumari, I guess it's in the southern part of India, visiting a monument early in the morning with lots of other people. And suddenly, when he saw the effects of the tsunami and the water being drawn back, he realized what it was immediately and rushed everybody up to the top of this monument. And then he had a really incredible photo of how the water rushed back, and it reached just to the feet of everybody that was standing up on that ledge. And it was just for the sake that he had finished this project in his science class there in India, and he recognized what the effects of a tsunami was.
Wow, what an amazing story. I think science teachers everywhere would love to latch onto that one. That's really great. Thank you so much for sharing that, Ben.
Oh, you betcha.
Was that the tsunami that took place in 2004?
Yes.
Wow. Tim, you must have encountered people who had sort of close calls. Do they feel sort of divine providence? Do they feel providence, rather? Do they feel it's good luck that they survived, or simply their own wits?
Yeah, I think most of the people that I spoke with felt, I don't know if lucky, you know, many of them had survivor's guilt. One woman I met in Indonesia, she said, you know, she still wakes up screaming, or wakes up hearing people screaming in her dreams at night. She remembers telling some of her family members to leave their building and run, and they didn't survive. And she wonders, well, if she hadn't said anything, if they'd stayed in their building, maybe they would have survived. And this particular woman, she hopped on the back of her uncle's motorbike, and she was driving down this main street in Banda Aceh in Sumatra, Indonesia, and she looked over her shoulder, and at first she couldn't make sense of what she was looking at. She saw, you know, this black, oily wall, and that was the water of the tsunami. And it was carrying a ship between buildings, and it was just this cognitive dissonance. She couldn't make sense of that picture for a few seconds. Then, and just everyone has, you know, horrible stories like in Banda Aceh, especially. Everyone knows people who died, often, you know, family members who died, and, you know, just terrible stories.
There is one small, I mean, major to the people involved, but a silver lining in the Banda Aceh story that you include in the piece, which I had not been fully aware of. Can you talk about that?
Yes, it's kind of extraordinary. This province of Aceh in Indonesia, before the tsunami, had essentially a civil war going on for more than a decade. People were, you know, bodies were, you know, turning up, you know, in the street every morning, you know, decapitated. And the tsunami put an end to that, put an end to that civil war. And everyone that I spoke to mentioned that. They said that, for all the death and destruction that the tsunami brought, paradoxically, it also brought peace to the province of Aceh. And the influx of Western aid and Western relief workers opened up the society there a little bit. The province of Aceh is still now it's under Sharia law, so women are dressed conservatively. They wear, you know, if you're a Muslim woman, you have to wear a headscarf and dress conservatively. If you're not Muslim, you don't have to dress conservatively. But despite that, the society seems to have been liberalized somewhat. Coffee shops are open all hours. I went out one night and to a coffee shop that was just packed, and I watched these young, really young kids in rock bands singing in open-air cafes. Mm. One woman who had uncovered her hair, and she was just wearing blue jeans and a sleeveless shirt. She was belting out a song, but at one point she was interrupted because the management was worried that the Sharia police might come by, so they asked her to put on a headscarf. So she grabbed this headscarf and just kind of whipped it around in the air and put it on her head and resumed her song.
We have an email here that asks about whether it's true that animals can sense tsunamis before the waves arrive. Do you know anything about that research?
You know, I don't know a lot. I've heard of that, but I didn't really look into that for the story, but it's an interesting question. Mm-hmm.
And another email here from Kate in Dallas wanted you to speak more about the movements of the tectonic plates. She says, I read that part of the nuclear plant failure was the northern Japanese coast dropped several meters and that no amount of preparation could have anticipated this.
I don't know how much the area around the nuclear power plant dropped, but it's true that the damage to that plant was mostly caused by the tsunami. If it was a power plant in a bad position, in a bad location, just like many of our population centers are in bad places now. Why was that plant there? Probably not the best choice for building a nuclear power plant.
Is it fair to assume that wealthy countries will always weather these better than countries that are still developing?
I think so. It's tragic, but I think that's true. But as one of the earlier callers mentioned, Ben, with his story about that young person in India who had just done a science fair project, I've heard a number of stories like that. A young British girl was traveling in Thailand during a 2004 tsunami, and she also had a science lesson in her class, and she recognized the tsunami warning signs of the bay emptying out, and she was able to save people. So education maybe is just as important as erecting seawalls and evacuation centers. If you know what to do, if you're aware of your surroundings, if you know where the nearest high ground is, if you feel an earthquake and you're in an area that's had a history of tsunamis, you have to run. You can't wait to hear a warning sign. You can't wait for a local authority or a sheriff to tell you what to do, because as one person in the Pacific Northwest told me, you can't wait for your sheriff to warn you, because you have to start running, and if you look around beside you, you're going to see your sheriff running beside you too.
Yeah, and I guess, as the flood of water comes in, it's not simply the water. I mean, one might think, well, I can swim. It's all that debris floating around that can injure and kill people and pull them under.
That's it. It is the debris, and, just enormous things are moved, whole buildings. In Japan, I just saw enormous piles of cars and buses. In Banda Aceh, there is a city park now that has a 200-foot-long ship, weighs something like 2,600 tons, that was carried for more than a mile by the tsunami.
Wow.
There are horrific photos of injuries caused by the tsunami at an open-air park in Banda Aceh, and it's not that people drowned, it's that they're literally just torn apart and impaled by objects. Truly horrible. People... the body is just completely stripped of clothing. It's not simply being carried away and drowning. It's, as you said, the debris and enormous objects that are hurtling at, you know, more than freeway speeds in this water.
Is it scientists in the areas that are that tend to be affected that are doing the most important work in this area, or are there institutions in different parts of the world that sort of apply their knowledge from afar?
Yeah, it's both, actually. There are researchers all over the world. There are, I think scientists in areas that are, you know, likely to be affected by tsunamis, of course, have a vested interest, and they're probably the most actively involved researchers. But there are scientists in Germany who helped supply tsunami warning systems to Indonesia. So there are worldwide efforts to try to mitigate the losses that will happen during tsunamis.
Is there a reason to believe we will continue to get better at this, or is there a limit? I mean, it seems as if there's a point at which there's nothing we can do.
Yeah, in terms of protecting large cities, there is a limit. You can't just say move a city like Padang in Indonesia, a city of a million. You can't build 50-foot seawalls all along the coastlines in Washington, Oregon, and Northern California. But we can certainly, especially in the United States, we can certainly do a lot more. I think the warning system in the United States is quite good. But in terms of having the necessary evacuation centers, we need to do a lot of work there.
Were you happy to return home to landlocked Gallup, New Mexico, after you were done with this piece?
You know, I'm always happy to return home, especially after this was a long trip, involved about a month of travel.
Mm-hmm.
But it was such a moving experience, just meeting the different people in Japan and Indonesia, and hearing their stories, and staying in touch with them since then. But yeah, where I am, it's and probably where you are too, the tsunami risk is pretty low.
Yes, we're thankful for it. I think it's pretty much non-existent here. So we really appreciate the work. And the article by Tim Folger is called "The Calm Before the Wave." It appears in the February 2012 issue of National Geographic magazine. Tim, it's been a really interesting conversation. Thank you so much for sharing with us everything that you've learned.
Well, thank you very much, Chris, for having me.
Today's show was engineered by Shelley Canavy. Joe Bilotti answers the phones. Christine McConnell produces the podcast. And the senior producer of Think is Jeff Whittington. You can learn more about the show and find out about upcoming programs, as well as download our free daily podcast at kera.org/think. Email comments, questions, and any suggestions you have to think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thank you for listening, and have a great day.